Now, we're doing philosophy of science today and Friday. Yes?
I just have a question about Aristotle. So he believed in God, and yet he didn't believe in the realm of the intelligible.
But see, for Aristotle, you can only understand these forms by way of particulars. And that's why Aristotle concentrated so much on the nature of the world around him. That's why he engaged in his classification of plants and animals and so on. He carried on what we would call a scientific interest. Which Plato was entirely indifferent to this. You don't find Plato messing around with the natural world at all. Plato wants to go instantly and immediately from the intellect to the realm of ideas. For Aristotle, there are these forms very definitely, but you can only understand this stuff by way of the world around you. Fair enough? Okay. Okay, it's philosophy of science. Now, this is the first of our topics where we are dealing with the philosophy of a particular subject. We're going to deal with the philosophy of science, we're going to deal with the philosophy of history, and at the end of the course, we're going to deal with the philosophy of art and the philosophy of religion. Our topics up to this point have been the most general topics. When we go into the philosophy of a particular subject, what we're trying to do is to ask the most fundamental questions about that discipline. We are not getting into the details of how the discipline operates. We're not asking how questions or what questions. We're asking why questions about these disciplines. And theoretically, you can do philosophy about any subject in that sense. Philosophy of music or whatever. Philosophy of rat catching. Well, maybe not rat catching, but, you know, in principle, you could do this sort of thing. All right. The first issue we want to deal with in the philosophy of science has to do with the difference between scientific method and what Edwin A. Burt, my old philosophy professor at Cornell University, called the religion of science. It is extremely important that we see the difference between these two things. First, scientific method or empirical method. This is the approach that is used in all of the sciences to discover the nature of the world. Scientific method or empirical method. They are synonyms. And how does scientific method work? Well, you get up off your rear end and you go out into the world and you examine it. You collect facts. And then you hypothesize the best explanation for these facts that you can come to. And then you test this hypothesis that it endeavors to explain the facts by looking for more facts to confirm or disconfirm your hypothesis. The hypothesis then gets refined by way of more and more empirical investigation. And the terminology here is generally that at the outset you call your explanation a hypothesis. If the data are successful in confirming this to a very large extent, the hypothesis rises to the level of a theory. And if the glorious results of long investigation and long confirmation is that your explanation is a peachy, peachy explanation, it seems to handle everything and doesn't create any problems at any level, we will call this a law, a scientific law, from hypothesis to theory to scientific law. Now notice that even when we reach the level of law, we have not reached the level of absolute certainty, because all of this is grounded in our data. And theoretically, you could come across data eventually that would disconfirm the law. Or maybe you haven't done a sufficient investigation. Maybe there are areas of investigation that should have been done and haven't been done. Any scientific investigation can only reach levels of high probability. They cannot reach a level of absolute certainty. Absolute certainty is possible only in the realms of pure logic, or deductive logic and pure mathematics. Those areas, as we've already pointed out, are areas of pure formality. Logic and mathematics don't depend upon facts. They interrelate facts that have been discovered elsewhere. The reason why you have absolute certainty in deductive logic and in pure mathematics is that the certainty is built in. Remember that thrilling course in plane geometry you had in high school? Oh, wasn't that glorious? I mean, people wept with joy in the course in plane geometry. And at the end of your proofs, you wrote QED, quod erat demonstrandum, which must be so demonstrated. It gave you a sense of confidence and security. Here you are on solid ground. But the only reason that you could write that and have that feeling of certainty is that your proof was just a consistent derivation from the axioms of plane geometry. You started with axioms. And the proof was nothing but a consistent following out of those axioms. Axioms such as you can only have one line perpendicular to the same line in the same plane. You know, stuff like that. So the certainty is a logical certainty that follows from the axioms of the system. The minute you get into factual data, you're not in the realm of certainty. You're in the into the realm of probability. Now, this is really important because it doesn't apply just in the area of scientific data. It applies to any factual data. Our case for Christianity is a historical case. That case doesn't rise to the level of absolute certainty. But the non-Christian has no business saying, well, if you can't give me a certain proof of Christianity, I'm not going to bother. He hasn't got any right to argue that way because he can't argue that way about any other facts. He's in exactly the same situation where scientific fact is concerned as he is when he is listening to the historical evidence for Christian faith, for example. The issue is simply, does the evidence rise to a sufficient level that it's reasonable to accept it? Here's another way of looking at it. In all areas of fact, the evidence rises to a certain level. Ultimately, we commit ourselves to the proposition, whatever it happens to be. The distance between the evidence and the commitment is faith. Faith jumps the gap from the evidence to commitment. And that goes on in every factual realm. Faith is not something that's limited to the religious sphere. When you cross the street, you look both ways with great care, because your mother told you to. And you check the situation, and maybe you've got an 80% chance of getting across the street without being reduced to 1/16th of an inch in thickness. Maybe. And so you cross the street. And when you do, you take 100% of yourself. Most people do. Most people do not leave 20% of themselves on that side and only cross with 80%. When you cross with 100% of yourself and the evidence is only 80% of getting across, you are exercising faith. Faith jumps the gap from probability to certainty. And by the way, if you're in California where there are a lot of Porsches, your chances are much less than you think they are. And some of you, I suppose, have seen the Roadrunner cartoons, you know. So, you know, in all of life, it's a matter of jumping the gap from probability to certainty by faith. And that goes on in science just as it does in all other factual realms. People so often get the idea that when you move into science, you're moving into the area of absolute certainty. Nonsense. Of course you're not. You want absolute certainty? Become a mathematician. But then the only reason you got the absolute certainty is because you've defined it in through the axioms that you've accepted at the outset. All right? Well, what's the religion of science then? The religion of science is a non-recognition of this, the feeling that science is somehow an absolute, and that you can reach absolute certainty by messing around in the scientific realm. It's turning scientific method into a religion, as it were, without really understanding what's going on. If you go to my Quest for Absolutes, which is part of the stuff that we distributed, you go to page 4 of that, and there I have quoted Dr. Edwin A. Burt on the religion of science, and he lists various assumptions of the religion of science. A philosophical school early in the 20th century created a kind of denomination out of the religion of science. And this particular position is called logical positivism. Logical positivism. And the chief representative of this in English was A.J. Ayer, A-Y-E-R, A.J., his initials, A.J. Ayer, A-Y-E-R. Ayer was a British philosopher who, unfortunately, just before he died, wrote an autobiography in which he described all of his bizarre sexual activities. And even those who felt very comfortable with Ayer as a philosopher were very much embarrassed. I mean, if a person is going to have that kind of a hobby, it seems to me the least he could do is to shut up about it and, you know, not embarrass everybody. Well, that has nothing to do with his position. His position was presented in a book called Language, Truth, and Logic. Language, comma, Truth, and Logic. This went through several editions. And in the first edition of this, Ayer said, the only way to knowledge is experiment. If it can't be boiled over a low flame in a laboratory, it's not knowledge, and we shouldn't even bother with it. The result of this was that Ayer rejected ethics, art, literature, religion, and just about everything is not actually imparting knowledge at all. This was the narrowest kind of understanding of the world. He narrowed everything down to laboratory experiment. Of course, people pointed out to him that this was idiocy, right? And Ayer occasionally did listen to other people. And in later editions, he admits that, for example, historians can provide reasonable information about the past. You know, great concession here. You know, I mean, we can actually say that Napoleon lost the Battle of Waterloo when the chips are down, right? Or when his chips were down. But Ayer still would not give any truck at all to art and religion, particularly religion. the religion of science then limits the world to a very narrow understanding of scientific method. An example of this kind of thing today is, of course, Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins has just published a book, which you will find available in all the large bookstores here and in England. And the book is entitled The God Delusion. Dawkins is an atheist, and Dawkins became very famous for a book a couple decades ago entitled The Blind Watchmaker. And in the book The Blind Watchmaker, Dawkins says, yes, it looks as if there is intelligent design in the world, but that's just the way it happens to look. The fact of the matter is, all of this has come about by chance evolutionary development. I've done a small critique of this in the latest issue of the Global Journal of Classical Theology, which is now Patrick Henry's. And if you go to the website for Patrick Henry, and you go to the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, and you go down the list, at the bottom of the list of various subpages is the Global Journal. You click on that, and you have all of the archived issues of the Global Journal for 8 years there and available to you. And the latest issue, I've done the editorial, I'm the editor, so I do the editorials. The editorial to the latest issue is, I think it's the latest issue. If it isn't, it's the issue just before that, deals with Dawkins, and it might be fun for you to see what I have to say. But just as an example of the religion of science, I want to read you a couple of paragraphs from a letter that Richard Dawkins wrote to his teenage daughter to try to help her to become a more mature person. And, of course, to avoid any chance that she could go into religion or mess around with religion. Okay. Listen to this. One of the kinds of bad reasons for believing anything is called revelation. If you had asked the Pope in 1950 how he knew that Mary's body disappeared into heaven, that's the, what do you call it? Not the Ascension, but the of the Virgin Mary. There's a Catholic holiday. Mary is supposed to have been taken directly up into heaven. Assumption, exactly. It's the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin. Yes. Uh-huh. Okay. If you asked the Pope in 1950 how he knew that Mary's body disappeared into heaven, he would probably have said that it had been revealed to him, in quotation marks. He shut himself in his room and prayed for guidance. He thought and thought all by himself, and he became more and more sure inside himself. Incidentally, that isn't at all how the Roman Catholic Church got to the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin. Not in the slightest. No pope ever went into a room, you know, and began, you know, and the Assumption came to the... This is a piece of medieval tradition, huh, which has been stamped with approval. And it was only stamped with approval, by the way, in the 20th century. Before that, you could deny it with no trouble at all and be a good Catholic. Now you can't. Same problem with the infallibility of the Pope. That was declared at the First Vatican Council in 1870. In 1865, you could consider the Pope wrong all the time and still be a good Catholic, but you can't now. Anyway, he goes on. When religious people just have a feeling inside themselves that something must be true, even though there is no evidence that it is true, they call their feeling revelation. Surprise! You'd never thought that that's what revelation meant, did you? What revelation means, according to Dawkins, is when people have a feeling inside themselves, even though there's no evidence for it, that's revelation. It isn't only popes who claim to have revelation. Lots of religious people do. It's one of their main reasons for believing the things that they believe. And the last paragraph of this letter to the poor teenager. Oh gosh. He should have been taken before the courts in terms of the principle of the best interests of the child. Anyway, what can we do about all this? It is not easy for you to do anything because you were only 10, not a teenager, you're 10 years of age. But you could try this. You could try this. Next time somebody tells you something that sounds important, think to yourself, is this the kind of thing that people probably know because of evidence? Or is it the kind of thing that people only believe because of tradition, authority, or revelation? Tradition, authority, or revelation. And next time someone tells you that something is true, why not say to them, what kind of evidence is there for that? And if they can't give you a good answer, I hope you'll think very carefully before you believe a word they say. Your loving daddy. And by the way, if you are an atheist, I'm not sure what the word loving could mean. Huh? I don't know how you justify a concept of love evidentially under those circumstances. But my point here is that Dawkins assumes here that any religious claims have no evidence for them. He defines revelation as inner experience. He never faces the question of whether, maybe God did come to earth and showed himself by many infallible proofs, as the book of Acts says. He dismisses this out of hand. That's the religion of science. We agree that if there's no evidence for something, don't bother with it. We agree with this. That's absolutely correct. That's scientific method. But it is not scientific method to dismiss whole areas of human experience without even checking to see whether there's any evidence that operates in those realms. See the difference? The difference between scientific method and the religion of science. Now, another point along the same line. Is it true that in order to be scientific, you've got to be able to do laboratory experiment? Is repeatable experimentation necessary for scientific method? Answer, no. No, it isn't. There are areas of science, legitimate areas of science, where it is impossible to do repeatable experiments. Example, paleobotany. Paleobotany deals with plants that once existed and no longer exist. So it's awfully hard to experiment with them. What you can do is to observe the fossil record of those plants, but that's not the same thing as experimenting with the plants in the laboratory. The paleobotanist operates very much like the historian operates. He checks the evidence for past events. In astrophysics, it is extremely difficult to boil a distant star over a low flame in the laboratory. You are dealing with data beyond your direct manipulation. Why is it important to emphasize this? Because people like A.J. Ayer tend to dismiss historical arguments because they say these are not scientific. Listen, you don't have to dig up Napoleon and experiment with him in order to arrive at a conclusion as to who won or lost the Battle of Waterloo. The way the historian operates is indeed scientific. What he does is to look at the data, then he derives the best kind of explanation from the data possible. He checks this against more data and arrives at a conclusion. Experiment is not necessary here. What is necessary is the collecting of facts and the testing of facts and arriving at a conclusion as to what the best explanation of the facts would be. All right, so religion of science is distinguished from proper scientific method. We go with proper scientific method. We do not go with the religion of science. Second issue in the philosophy of science. The Kuhn thesis, K-U-H-N, Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N. The philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn, some 20 years ago, set forth the following argument. Said he, the great revolutions in science, the great changes in scientific perspective, are really changes in philosophical viewpoint. There's a change in worldview. These are not the result of facts forcing people to move from one position to another. They are rather a different way of looking at the world. Now, what does that position amount to? What Kuhn is saying is that really, scientists are metaphysicians. They may think they're working scientifically, but they're really metaphysicians. They're metaphysicians who have a cosmic worldview, and then that cosmic worldview shifts. There's a shift in the point of view from which one looks at the world. Scientific changes, then, are really disguised philosophical changes. Yes?
So would this be like when Copernicus, or whatever that guy's name was, had his thing about the Earth not being within the universe anymore, that like, in reality that was more of a reflection of humanity starting over.
Well, yeah, and it is perfectly true, for example, that Copernicus was much influenced by the cosmic perspective of his time. Copernicus, for example, lived about the same time as the Age of Discovery, when people were going out and discovering new worlds and that kind of thing. Everything was opening up, and Europe no longer seemed to be the necessary center of everything, right? So it would be perfectly natural to begin thinking that maybe the Earth wasn't the center of everything, huh? And that the Earth went around the sun instead of the sun going around the Earth, and so the shift from a Ptolemaic viewpoint. Let me give you a better example of this. And this is one that Kuhn doesn't place any special emphasis on, but would have been a much better support for that viewpoint. Take the theory of evolution that was first promulgated, of course, by Darwin in his Origin of Species. The book The Origin of Species was published in 1859, middle of the 19th century. And when it was reviewed in the New York Times, the reviewer said, "We don't understand why everyone is getting so excited about this. Actually, Darwin is simply saying that in the area of biology, everything is improving, but we already knew that everything was evolving." Because the 19th century is the great century of progress, in quotes, where industrialization is moving on, the large corporations are coming on the scene without federal income tax at that point, and so they're really, and the capitalists are grinding down on the proletariat. The workers are working night and day, and everybody's, and they're not getting richer, but the capitalists are getting richer, and the whole situation looks like it's just blazing ahead. Everybody believed naively in progress in the 19th century. That's the century of Hegel and the century of Marx. The dialectic moving onward and upward to higher and higher levels. Now, Kuhn would say, sure, the shift in the direction of evolutionary theory was perfectly natural in a context like this and doesn't really depend on data. Now, in that particular instance, I agree with him 1,000%. The data in favor of biological evolution is trivial. And the number of logical fallacies connected with evolutionary theory are extraordinary, just extraordinary. And I think that evolutionary theory did indeed arise as a cultural phenomenon, not by scientific necessity. Howsoever, you can't generalize from that to the entire history of science, for heaven's sake. That isn't the way most scientific change has come about. In fact, it's the way that scientific fallacies have come on the scene, not the way that good science moves. Yes?
Just to make sure I'm understanding the distinction you're making between using the scientific method and the religion of science, are you basically saying that Bacon's idea of the scientific method and induction can be good, but it's not good if we make it our religion, like he did in the New Atlantic?
Yeah, that's one way to put it. What I'm particularly concerned about are those who take a very narrow view of scientific method and then insist that only that narrow view will provide knowledge, that you can't get anywhere in any other way. And by narrow, I mean that these people will not apply a good, broad scientific method to questions other than materialistic questions. Okay? Yes?
So basically, Kuhn's criticism of science and history of science is pretty similar to the way that we see Dawkins criticizing Christianity, that both of those changes and both of all those assumptions are held by tradition or are held by emotion and feeling rather than by the facts.
Well, yes, except that Dawkins considers that unfortunate, whereas Kuhn thinks that this is perfectly natural, and that's the way science does move, and we can't criticize it for being that way. See, what Kuhn is really doing is trying to argue that science is disguised philosophy, or it's disguised metaphysics. He's really saying that science is disguised metaphysics. Most people would contrast science with metaphysics, as I did in my first lectures. I pointed out, for example, that in science, bad views disappear on the basis of evidence, leaving better views. Whereas in metaphysics, all of the views are still around because there's no way to criticize them. All right, Kuhn is saying, not at all. The fact is that science is actually doing metaphysics, just like the philosophers are doing it. We're moving from one scientific worldview to another, really on the basis of cultural and axiomatic factors, not on the basis of direct evidence. Kuhn is a kind of scientific presuppositionalist, if you will. He's saying in science, you start from presuppositions, actually, presuppositions of content, and these shift, these change as people get a different view of the world. Okay, and the changes are not due to discovering a better factual understanding of things. They are due to non-factual considerations. Now, even Kuhn, however, has to admit in his classic, this is called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, the book that Kuhn did that sets this forth, it's called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Even in that book where he says that science moves by philosophical revolution and not by factual investigation, even in that book, he has to admit in a couple of places that it was that a change from one view to another took place because of crucial experiment. Somebody performed an experiment. The experiment didn't go with the previous view, but did go with the new view, and therefore the change took place. But the minute he admits this, it destroys his position. Because if science moves on the basis of factual information, it's not metaphysics. Okay? And I will give you an example of this. Okay, there is a book that has just been published, 2006. That's not just, well, it's 2 years ago. Okay, 2006. This is a book published by Princeton University Press. The author of it is Crelinston. Terrible. C-R-E-L-I-N-S-T-E-N. I repeat that. C-R-E-L-I-N-S-T-E-N. Crelinston. Jeffrey is his first name. This is not Jeffrey, 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 Jeffrey. You know, this is another. This is J-E-F-F-R-E-Y, not the British G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y. This is J-E-F-F-R-E-Y. Collinson, the title of the book, Einstein's Jury. Einstein's Jury. Subtitle, The Race to Test Relativity. The Race to Test Relativity. Here is what one reviewer has said about this book. Listen to this. This is an author in his own right who reviews Collinson's book. The person who's quotation I'm now going to read is Clifford Will, W-I-L-L. He's at Washington University in St. Louis, and he's the author of a book entitled, Was Einstein Right? And this is what Will says. Since the 1960s, scientists have shown with exquisite precision that Einstein was right about relativity. But for relativity's first two decades, 1910 to 1930, the case for Einstein was hardly a slam dunk. Jeffrey Crelinson tells the exciting roller coaster story of the early experimental tests of special and general relativity, from light deflection measurements to ether drift tests. Believers debated skeptics, but in the end, the jury was swayed by the data. Huh? Believers debated skeptics over the correctness of the Einsteinian theory. Huh? But in the end, the jury was swayed by the data. It was, for example, the Michelson-Morley experiments on the speed of light that had so much to do with the acceptance of the Einsteinian theory. The Kuhn thesis is, as a general theory of science, is wrong. It's wrong. It does, however, illumine how you can get bad science. You can get bad science by allowing cultural issues to give you your scientific principles instead of going to the data and finding the results that way. Yes?
What impact did the Kuhn thesis have on logical causes? Did it affect the software it stood, or the bug caused to the positivism still alive and breathing today?
Well, logical positivism has been much chastened. It actually began in Austria. It's called the Vienna. It was originally called the Vienna School. Vienna School, and then later logical positivism. And it finally out of that came the best formulation of the verification principle. Originally, people like Ayer said, you can only verify by boiling over a low flame. Then, as a result of chastening and that sort of thing, they ultimately got to the point of saying, all right, as long as you can tell us how you would verify or disconfirm a position, that position is going to be meaningful. But if you can't give any means of confirming or disconfirming your position, then, you know, forget it. So, actually, as logical positivism developed, it became a very good kind of thing. It insisted on verification. But in its early stages, it was definitely a reductionist approach that confused the religion of science with the scientific method. Okay? How are we doing? Ooh, dear me, suz. Aren't we supposed to have ended this class? Yes, but you know, the nice thing is that I never charge the extra tuition for those minutes. All right, see you next time.